There's literally nothing but time right now. We need to rest and heal and be quiet, probably, and I don't know, other stuff. Podcast. Yeah. We need to podcast.
That's we do. Oh, my God. Okay. So, hello. Welcome to our podcast.
Oh, yeah. Hey, this is Special Lady Day. I'm Jessica.
And I'm Caitlin. And thank you for staying with us.
This is week 575 of quarantine time.
I know.
JK.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And also, this is such an exciting podcast because if everything goes well, I'm crossing my fingers. We have been trying to get this episode out to you guys for so long.
Weeks.
Yeah.
Years.
Yeah. And so we've been like putting out little things on our feed, little Instagram stories about it.
Right. Don't forget us.
And we explained already, so we're not going to explain it again. But we're just so excited to be here. And also that our podcast is pandemic resistant.
Yeah.
We don't have to change anything.
No, because we're doing it all remote.
Yeah.
And I know what you're thinking, but your banter, so warm, so lively. It's as if you're in the same room, to which I would say, thank you, Mom. That is a really nice compliment. And in fact,
we are 90 miles away from each other.
90 miles, but together forever in our hearts. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the bear.
Oh, yeah. Jessica has a bear in her office, so if we reference a bear, that's what it is. And by a bear, I mean a tiny stuffed animal bear that's been with you forever and actually appeared in my wedding photos.
That's right. Yeah. I forgot.
Yeah.
He's also in my wedding photos, and now he is nestled very gently in my cleavage.
It looks like he was born for that seat.
I am his kangaroo mother, and I have lost my damn mind. Well, Caitlin, here's the thing. We have exciting ladies to talk about, and special shout out to frequent friend of the podcast, Ron. We were in touch recently, and he said to me that he appreciated the special lady backlog in this time of social distancing.
I love that so much. And it makes my heart so happy.
I know. I was like, oh, buddy. It made me really happy.
I'm so glad.
I know.
I'm like, it's helping someone out there.
A person? And a good person.
Yeah.
So, thanks, Ron. You're the best. And we're going to add to that backlog right now with some...
And it's so cool we have a backlog.
Facts. We do. We do. It's great.
So, we've had a bit of a sound desert, and now we're just going to grow you the paradise oasis you've always wanted.
Midnight at the Oasis. Yeah. Okay.
Special ladies popping up on trees.
On trees.
growing out of the trees.
They're just like inexplicable. It's just like, oh, this is a lovely birch tree. Meryl Streep, where did you... How did you get out of the... What the... RBG, you get out of that elm. Come on. How'd you scale that thing?
But it's our special lady oasis.
Oh. Midnight at the Oasis, indeed. Oh, I dropped my notes. Okay.
And let's give people a heads up. So, yes. as we've said before, we've already heard each other's special ladies. So rather than pretending that we are surprised by them, we're just going to go into it, sharing it with each other again. I'm excited to hear the story again.
I am too.
But also, we're going to approach this more as like, we're both super pumped about them and you're the expert, but I have some highlights that I love.
I love everything about that except for the part where I'm an expert, but the rest of it is A-okay. I'm so excited to get back into these special ladies. I'm really excited to talk about mine, and I had a lot of fun talking about her with you before. So I say let's dive right into it. Are you ready?
Let's do it. Yeah, I can't wait.
Wonderful. Everybody grab your tiny bears.
Mm-hmm.
Get your little sippers, your fizzy waters, your whatnots.
Yeah.
And join me on a ride. Hop in the car. You don't even have to worry about social distancing because this is all in your imagination. We're holding each other consensually and we're holding each other close. And we're going back to Hollywood, and we're going to meet an amazing woman named Frances Marion. Frances Marion.
Love her so much. Can we talk about some great things about her, or should we just let the story roll out?
I mean, let me give my sources.
Okay, sorry. I'm just so excited.
No, I love that you're excited. I kind of love that you know the lady I'm covering.
I know, it's fun. I like the surprise, too, though. This is like a nice change up, but I wouldn't have it that way all the time.
I understand. I'm really tempted to start feeding this tiny bear Sauvignon Blanc. Sip. All right. It's not related to what we're talking about. Here are my sources. Okay, so the first one that was really delightful was a YouTube video series hosted by the one and only Hilary Swank, Bellingham native.
Oh.
I don't know if you
knew
that.
I think you said that last time, yeah. But I have forgotten it, yeah. And so I'm so excited to relearn it.
The series was called Real Women, R-E-E-L, film reel. It was about women in the film industry. And this one covered Frances Marion. It's quite nice. Also, a Time magazine article called This Forgotten Female Screenwriter Helped Give Hollywood Its Voice by Erin Blakemore. Also, the Women Film Pioneers Project's entry on Frances Marion by Joanne Rivoli. And then this was a Refinery 29 article. This is often where the research starts, I'm not going to lie. Refinery 29 will be like, 16 women that died in a way that is surprising that you should probably know. And I'm like, oh.
I probably should know that.
27 astrophysicists that worked in a cubicle you never saw before. And so this one was called, sorry, no shame, Refinery 29. It just always cracks me up. It's like clickbait for white feminists. Mm-hmm. All right. So this, I'm getting sassies because I had wine before five. This article was called 17 Women Who Made History That You've Never Heard Of. And it was a great article by Jess Kwong. Featured a lot of incredible women and included Frances Marion. And that is how I discovered her.
Sorry, I just totally interrupted you. You were about to do something. But something that you talked about last time was like, your thought process about finding her in your research. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I was feeling this kind of way about it where it feels like it's been 500 months, but I think it's still Women's History Month. I don't remember because, as we talked about earlier, time has lost all meaning. So that could be untrue.
It's somebody's month.
If it is. I found myself kind of in this place where I was like, I am really sad that almost all of the research I do about unknown women, these true stories have a trajectory of trauma, violence, incredible heartbreak and defeat, and then like overcoming it, kind of, right? Mm. And I was looking through, I think it might have been in the 17 Women Who Made History article. I was reading through it, and it was like two of the women that were featured were involved in this really important, like, sexual harassment lawsuit. And, you know, they did all, like, that was so important. And it is important. I'm not saying that going to court and speaking out and going through all that isn't, obviously, it's crucial. But it's like, da-da-da-da, stars around their name. They were horribly harassed for a really long time at their place of work instead of just being able to live. Mm-hmm. And I kind of was like, I'm sick of this being the history. And I think that as you go through, as you start to look at other marginalized identities and different intersections, right, mm-hmm. of these groups and identities, the stories often that are presented that are kind of canonized, even when it's like you're uncovering it, you're uncovering this unknown thing, are still really rooted in something that occasionally, this feels a little bit dramatic to say, but that occasionally feels a little bit like trauma porn to me. Mm-hmm. Like, look at how traumatizing it is. And I forget where I read this. I really wish I remembered, but I remember seeing on Instagram a meme or a post, a woman saying something like, stop you know, stop saying, look at everything that this, you know, trans woman has overcome, and just, like, tell the stories of our normal, like, simple, boring lives. Like, that should be enough. Just the lives we're living. Why does it always have to be, you know, like, overcame adversity? And obviously, this is, like, a complicated, very nuanced thing. You want to tell those stories. You don't want people to forget. You want to bring them to light. But I just felt this kind of weird pull in me where I was like, I don't, it's not that I want to shy away from the sad or the implicating stories, think stories that even implicate me, right, as a white woman. I don't want to shy away from that. But I also don't want every single history that I bring to this to be like, and then the terrible thing happened. Yeah. And look at how great she was. And then the terrible thing happened. But look at how amazing she was. And so I was like, I just want to find a woman. Like, I want to find a story just this time.
Yeah.
That's like, and nothing sensationally bad happened. And I also recognize this is a long rant. I recognize that having that kind of a life often is directly related to having an immense amount of privilege.
Absolutely.
Like, and so I'm not saying, like, I don't know what I'm saying. I don't know. I'm feeling conflicted about it.
I think what you're talking about, though, is you need to have a variety of stories. And and you also don't want to fall into narrating people's lives in a certain arc that their lives don't necessarily reflect. And, like, trying to fit it in. So I think, and I guess what I admire about what you're saying is, like, you don't want to have these traumas become a form of entertainment or the only story.
Exactly.
I would recommend, if people want to know more about this, I would look at Roxane Gay's essay about Black suffering in film. It's in her Bad Feminist book. And she talks a lot about, like, how, like, Black suffering has become a form of entertainment, and the only stories you see about Black people are suffering. You look at, like, 12 Years a Slave and things like that, and it's important to tell those stories, but you also need a variety of stories. And she was like, what about the concept of, like, Black joy? Is it possible to see a Black person be joyful? You know? And so it's not that you hide it, it's just that you have more. Thank you for explaining that so well, and thank you for indulging my question, because I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, no, of course. I'm happy. I feel honestly really clumsy with it. I feel really clumsy with it. I don't really know where to land with it. Privilege-wise, I'm like the fucking, you know, Gold Star Privilege Olympics type situation. Yeah. I'm like, I'm white. I'm straight. I'm upper middle class. I'm, you know, educated. I'm, able-bodied. All these things, right? Like, I'm at the, like, feast table of opportunity 24/7. Mm-hmm. And so even kind of going in and doing this research, there's a questioning that happens for me where I'm like, am I telling a story and it's good? Am I gaining from someone's history? It's something I'm always thinking about, and I don't have an answer for it.
I think it's really important that you're asking those questions. And I also think it's really important that you don't, like, just jump to an answer right away. And so that's okay. And I think, like, the answers change as we change and things like that. And so it's kind of important to continue asking those questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think we just have to get a whole lot more comfortable questions. I feel like that's my project as, like, a writing teacher. Is like, my students will be like, I just don't know. And I'm like, that's okay. Tell me all the things that you don't know. Or, like, tell me all the questions that you have, and that's fine. Like, there's this desire to be like, and I have the answer, and just trying to push them away from that, because when you say that, usually something is always left out.
Right. For our separate podcast called Jessica and Caitlin Drink White Wine and Talk About Pedagogy in the Western Canon. Can you imagine? Totally. And, like, what kind of knowledge is we privilege, right? Like, the difference between privileging questions versus answers, on and on and on. Yeah.
That's... But I think we all just have to get more cozy with questions.
Get cozy with questions, 2020. Okay. It's you, it's me, it's this tiny bear stuffed into the top of my shirt. We are ready.
Okay, I'm so ready to hear about... Okay. Her name is Frances Marion. Marion Francis.
You better believe it's Francis Marion.
Okay.
And fun fact, I have a niece named Francis now. It's really exciting. Anyway, unrelated, but shout out to Franny, who does not listen to this because she is a child. All right. Francis Marion. So I remember the first time I introduced her, I said this opening line, and you were like, ooh, tell me more. And I don't have any more information for you. However, we do know that Francis Marion was named after a famous Revolutionary War hero. Oh, yeah. That's cool.
Go research it on your own.
Go have a great time finding out about that hero. And I didn't do a lot of deep dive into her very early life. By a lot, I mean hardly any at all. So we're mostly going to look at her life as she's moving into her artistic career, okay? So we know that Frances Marion, as a young woman, she's dabbling in modeling. She's dabbling in acting. And
she's just dabbling.
She's dabbling. A dabble do ya. This is all before she works as a commercial artist and a war correspondent.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What time period are we in again?
I'm going to say it's World War I. That she's a war correspondent.
Oh, okay, that would make sense.
Gonna really hope that's right.
One of the big ones.
Because I have forgotten. Yes. She's doing all of that, and she eventually makes her way to Hollywood. All right?
As one does.
And as one does, you know, from the battlefield to Hollywood. That's an incredible journey, let's just be honest. And she's doing well, right? The dabbling, etc. But she's really, really interested in what happens behind the camera. This is where she's like, tell me more. Show me more. And she becomes the assistant to Lois Weber, who at the time was the most successful female director in Hollywood. And she starts to learn every aspect of film production. So I just want to pause and say, shout out to all of the amazing women in my life whom have been doing or researching or participating in something that I, as a younger woman or as an older woman or as whatever age I was, came up to them and was like, that seems kind of cool. What is that? And they're like, honey, let me pull the whole curtain back. You come back here and I will show you everything. It's a special woman in your life that's like, I'm going to teach you about this.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're interested. And I, oh, God love them. So Lois Weber is this woman for her. She's like, yep, let me show you how to do it. So a little bit about the era before we get going, because I thought this was so fascinating. This is the silent movie era. And silent movies film, the film industry in general at this point, is still kind of scrappy. It's not the huge Hollywood machine, nowhere near what we see now. You know, stage performances, that's what's really getting the focus. And so people aren't really thinking much of film. They're like, it's a passing fancy. Like, it's going to go away. And so as is the case, often throughout our history, when people aren't thinking it's like super important yet, a lot of women are working in film because they can. They're like, oh, sure, yeah, let these women do it. It's not important. And then these women are like, cool, we're just going to make amazing art for a while. And then it got really big. And these men are like, whoa, 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 whoa. What is this? What's happening over here? Get these broads out of the place. So that's kind of like a scene setting. And I love that idea of just like, this is sort of coming about and we don't know a whole lot about it. And we're just out here and we're making movies. We're involved in every aspect of it. We're just going for it. We don't even have a script necessarily in these silent movies. We have like an outline and we're just building it with our hands as we go. And there's just so many women around. It's this like kind of amazing age of the female filmmaker or the or women being filmmakers, to the point where it's believed that at least half of the films that were made, at least in America, in the 1910s to the 1920s were written by women.
That's amazing. And I had no idea until you told me that.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Okay. So back to our dear friend Frances. Her first job when she was writing dialogue, her first writing job, was writing dialogue for extras in case anyone watching the movies could lip read. which I love.
Since you told me that, I've been watching extras now, and I'm like, what are they saying? Has somebody been writing their dialogue?
Right? Okay, what would they be saying? Because if there's someone in the audience that's paying attention and can read their lips, we don't want them to think they're just saying watermelon, watermelon, watermelon over and over again. As a tasty treat to show you where this is going, in 1945, a magazine referred to Frances Marion as the best screenwriter the motion picture world has ever known. So, here we go. All right.
I'm so ready.
This is where things kind of kick off for her. She becomes friends with a little-known actress, Mary Pickford. Shock and awe. NBD.
Friendship is formed.
Friendship. The power of women who are friends. So amazing. Oh, women's friendships.
You know what? That's what we were going to do, because I had forgotten all of the fun ideas that came out of our last recording. Right. But we were talking about how, you very rarely get to hear about female friendships in celebrities.
Yes.
And you and I were like, what if we did a podcast, and as a joke, but what if we did a podcast that's like a gossip column, but it's just celebrity best friends
and only nice things, and then they fought, or then so and so did this. It's just like, did you hear the hot goss about how those women are supporting each other and setting boundaries,
lifting each other up and giving each other opportunities,
making room for everybody at the table and admitting when they're wrong,
and echoing each other's ideas to amplify them in the room.
Oh my god. Yeah. Wow.
I would totally read that gossip magazine.
It would be like my favorite magazine I ever read in my life. Oh.
Okay. So the OG Hollywood friendship.
Frances Marion and Mary Pickford. So Mary Pickford, her career is hitting a little bit of a lull. And she's like, you know what? Guess what? It's time for me to show the world that I have some comedy in the bag, so to speak. I'm pretty sure she never said that sentence ever. Not one time. But she's like, I want to do some comedy. And she goes to the studio. She's like, I want to do a comedic movie. They're like, great, great, great. And she's like, but I want my friend Frances Marion to write it. And they go, oh, yeah, that's not going to happen. Like, no. And she's like, hey, listen, I'm Mary fucking Pickford. If you want me, then you hire her. Which, power move, Mary Pickford. 100%. Love it. This is what we're talking about. Support your friends. So she gets the job. And I watched some clips of the movie, and it's super zany and really cute, and I love it so much. And there's just all kinds of travails and traipsing about and physical comedy, and I'm pretty sure someone gets a pie in their face. It's very exciting. And they have an amazing time making it. They're improvising on scene. They're ad-libbing as they go and just really hamming it up. They love it. They sit the executives down for a screening. The executives hate it. They're like, this is terrible. This is garbage. We're never going to release it. This is awful.
They were like, didn't anyone get the news that women can't be funny?
excuse me, ladies, but I have a peer-reviewed paper that I just wrote. So if you could read it. And also, I'm really into David Foster Wallace. Okay, so they say... that's absolutely terrible. We're not going to release it. But, here's the thing. It's Mary fucking Pickford, and they have a film that she's in sitting on the shelf. And they're like, okay, we actually kind of have to release this because people want it. So they do. And, oh my god, Caitlin, two women worked in perfect harmony to help each other realize each other's dreams and had a fun and very cohesive partnership that created what seemed to be an artistic project that would be meaningful in a lot of ways. And then a lot of men didn't like it, and then they released it. Oh my god, everyone loved it. The audiences loved it. It was a hit. Oh, guys. how many times do we have to prove it until we die? What I did love, okay, so there's a woman in the film, the Real Women Hillary Swank docu-series thing, and she was a friend, acquaintance. She's related to this scene. I'm not sure exactly how she was connected, but she said after that movie that either, I don't remember if it was Pickford or Frances Marion, but one of them said, "We learned then to never trust a screening with a room of suits making the judgments."
Ugh, I love it, because they don't know anything.
Ugh. And not only are they a power team, Frances Marion is hired to write movies full-time for Mary Pickford for $50,000 a year. Then.
What? And yeah, did we find out how much money that is now?
No, but I can tell it's you, a lot. By 1917, Frances Marion is making $2,500 a week, the highest salary of any screenwriter in Hollywood. Amazing. Amazing. Guess what? There's some more incredible things she did. How about she used to have weekly hen parties.
Oh my God, I love these.
Hen parties for women in the industry. So just real quick, first of all, we are bringing these back.
Oh, yeah.
For every industry.
Let's have our first, like, digital one.
Where, oh my God.
Where we have a, like, FaceTime hen party with our friends.
I love it. I love it so much. We could do it for women in podcasting.
Perfect. Do we know any other female podcasters?
Yes. Okay, we do.
Good.
We do.
You'll bring them. I'll bring...
Great.
The pets.
You bring the pets.
This is what really stuck out to me, is I just imagined these parties were so fun.
Oh.
And so freeing.
Yeah. Glitzy. Glammy. They're talking shit. They're like, hey, we work in movies. Do you really hate sexism? Me too. It's the fucking worst. They write parts for each other. They, like, figure out ways that they can network, that they can connect. They talk shop, right? And they are just always like, how do we keep supporting each other? Which I love this, right? I'm not worried about this woman being successful. If she's successful, I'm successful, right? Like, let's go.
I love that. That's the way it should be.
That is the way it should fucking be. But now we're going to hit just a quick, not a quick moment for her, but a moment of sadness for Frances Marion. So I haven't mentioned, but Frances Marion was married to a man named Fred Thompson. She loved very much, and they worked together, and they had a wonderful life together. They had two sons, and in 1928, tragedy strikes. He dies of undiagnosed tetanus. Okay? Oof. And she's left to be a single mom with these two kids. And she had been working for MGM. That's where she worked for the longest amount of her career. And she has to take a leave of absence. And obviously, she's grieving. I mean, this is horrible. And she stays away for a full year. All right? But the thing is, that particular year was maybe a rough year to be taking off in terms of film. Because the summer of 1929... Dun-dun-dun-dun, talkies, or, like, speaking movies with audio, come onto the scene. So, yeah. Like, imagine you're like, hey, I need to take a really important leave of absence, and you come back, and everything's different. Like,
yeah,
out the window.
That would be so hard.
Super hard, right? And people are really panicked, because they're like, can we... we have all these, like, really amazing silent film actors, but, like, can they... act with, I almost said with their mouths, but what I meant was with their voices. Can they act with their voices?
Can you act with your mouth?
Can you? A lot of questions. And not a lot of people can make the transition. I mean, they're two different art forms, right? Very, very difficult. But the head of MGM is like, you know what? Marion can do it. Frances Marion can do this.
She can, because she's been writing the dialogue all along for those extras.
All along, since the beginning.
It was a training she never knew she needed.
It's a lesson for us all. And not only does he really think she can do it, he thinks she can do it so fervently that he charges her to write Greta Garbo's first talkie movie.
Oh my God.
Okay. The movie version of Eugene O'Neill's play, Anna Christie. How do we think it does? It's just...
I bet it does an amazing job.
Oh, I mean, it only breaks all box office records and launches both Garbo and Marion into the new era. No big deal. Just a launching pad of success.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's really good. The next year, she starts writing The Big House, which was a movie inspired by an outcry for prison reform. It was called, quote, the most powerful prison drama ever screened. It's a huge success.
That's amazing.
She wins an Academy Award for screenwriting, the first that had ever been given to a woman, ever.
Oh my gosh.
And she's
like,
oh my
gosh, that's amazing.
Oh, this is really cool that I have an Academy Award, but you know what? I'm just going to real quick write this movie called The Champ, which is a super intense drama about a prize fighter who's an alcoholic and his son is like, Dad, don't fight anymore. And it's fine because next year she wins another Academy Award.
So like, she's just like, she has like these Oscars just like in her arms. Like, oh, boop. Look.
Boop. Just holding
my
these.
My mantle looks so beautiful now.
No big deal. And they talked a little bit in the, in that docuseries on YouTube how like she could really write in these spaces. She could write stories that traditionally have been in these stereotypical masculine themes that women weren't necessarily writing about. Or maybe they were writing about, but it was not assumed that they could. Right?
Yeah.
And she's like...
They were like traditionally or historically masculine areas.
Right. Right. Yeah. Masculine in this binary sense that they conceived of it at the time. Right? And she's like, well... In her own way, I like to imagine she's like, the binary is bullshit. Also.
Yeah. Also, I'm a good writer and I can write whatever.
That's right. P.S. Masculinity is what you want it to be. So, she does it all. And that's another movie you can check out. It seemed really cool. I saw a little clip
of
it.
I thought you were going to say She Does It All is a movie.
She Does It All is a movie. I wrote about her since we last talked. But it's just, it's very exciting. And she works at MGM for 20 years. But she leaves in 1946 at 58 years old because she was becoming increasingly disillusioned by what she referred to as the dwindling power of the Hollywood screenwriter. She described the work at that point as, quote, like writing on the sand with the wind blowing.
Wow.
And so we're right near the end now. So she moves to New York, and what do you do when you've had, like, an illustrious film career and made more money than anyone and won 2 Academy Awards? Well, Caitlin, you write your memoirs and you work as a sculptor. Obviously.
Oh, yeah! I forgot about her second chapter as a sculptor.
Second chapter as a sculptor! I mean,
that sounds so lovely.
I just want, like, a second chapter as, like, a professional lie about who watches The Real Housewives. And she had, like...
She's like, let me make more things.
Right. Like a real life thing.
Yeah.
She pens these memoirs. I can't say that word right now. But very sadly, she dies in 1972 of a ruptured aneurysm in Los Angeles.
Oh.
Couple more thoughts. In 1937, she wrote a handbook called How to Write and Sell Film Stories. So,
awesome.
You know, first of her time, it's fine. And then the title of her memoir was Off With Their Heads, A Seriocomic Tale of Hollywood.
I love that.
I like it very much. But the last thing I want to leave us with about her is this quote that I found when I was researching these hen parties. These hen parties that we are bringing back. We are bringing them back. And there's gonna be snacks.
There's going to be so many good snacks.
So many snacks at the Revolution. And the quote is, I owe my greatest success to women. Contrary to the assertion that women do all in their power to hinder one another's success, I've found that it has always been one of my own sex who has given me a helping hand when I needed it. And that is the story.
I love it.
Of the illustrious, never forgotten, Frances Marion, the best screenwriter the motion picture world had ever known.
Ugh, I love it so much.
Yeah.
And I just, the message that I love from her story is just, you know, we've been talking about it, but lifting other people up, bringing them along with you.
Yes.
Fighting for your friends, fighting for your female colleagues.
Yep.
She's such a model that we need to be following now.
Yes,
it's
absolutely.
So positive. And it's so counter everything that, like, corporate culture teaches us and things like that about getting ahead. It's just, yeah, it's the way it should be.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, God. That makes me sad to think about, but only for other reasons. I love so much about her, and I love imagining this film world that hadn't yet been discovered, the power of it, and the excitement of making art in that moment before it was taken over.
Yeah.
Right? Ugh.
Yeah, and there's probably just so much, like, invention and so much pride in what you do. And
yeah.
I mean, of course there is now, but, like, just being in the scrappy beginning side of it.
Right. And I think it's really cool to see in film the ways that people are doing that now when you see, like, oh, this person made this entire movie on their iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. Or this person's doing a whole comic web series on YouTube. Or right now, in the middle of this pandemic, how a lot of comedians are like, I'm doing a live stream comedy show on Instagram.
Yeah, I love that. I love it.
Like, we're gonna figure out ways to keep this happening, to keep art happening, to keep laughing, to keep enjoying each other and sharing all of this with each other, no matter what the circumstance.
I know.
Yeah.
Ugh, I love it so much. Oh, man, we could end there. Okay, I'm done. We have real good coming
up. Oh, we've got... Listen, this is... You've covered a lot of really amazing people, Caitlin. I would say this individual that you covered has the highest capacity for shrieking content from me.
I know, yes.
Where I'm
so
like...
So many shrieks.
Lean away from the mic. Make a sound that only dogs can hear over here. To the left.
Yeah.
There's so many OMGs and squeals. I'm going to try to keep it together.
It's so squeal-worthy. I'm so excited to share this person with you again. I think about her a lot, which I guess I think about my ladies a lot, but I don't know why this one, and I think our listeners will kind of get... I've just been reflecting on her a lot since we did her, and I'm just so excited to share her story with the world. Oh. And also... You know, I went back because I had, last time we did it, I had only two sources, and I was like, I want to be a better fact checker and, like, make sure I do the journalistic due diligence of having at least three. You know, there are a lot of articles about her, but they're in these archives of news sources that make you pay for a subscription.
Right.
To get in, because I was looking for, I wanted to follow up on some question marks I had, and I was like, you know what, there aren't a lot of free resources out there about her that actually include all of the information besides my main source. So actually, okay, I'm gonna walk back. There are 70 things I want to say all at once.
Of course.
They all should go first. Yes. And they can't. No. So here's the thing, I'll just go the way I have it in my script. I'm just going to trust it.
Yeah.
My research journey, you know how you were talking about how this lady produced a lot of excited squeals from you listening. Shrieks, I guess. I had that same experience when I was researching it. Because I was kind of like, I'm going to research this cool lady. She's in this area of, like, the world and time we haven't done before. And so I'm so excited. And then... As you know, I stumbled upon an ancient history mystery.
Okay. I need to interject immediately. I'm sorry. We're going to hit pause on you.
You can interject as many times as you
want. But this is really important. Caitlin, in the span of, like, less than 2 weeks, you have, A, stumbled upon an ancient history mystery.
Yep.
B, become a sound sleuth.
Oh my gosh.
And all of that, to me, points to the fact that you're actually a detective, you're on the scene, you're hot on the case, and I would like to invite you to be a part of my 1970s crime drama, Sunset Danger. It was something I wrote.
I want to be in Sunset Danger.
I'm not going to get into it a lot. I'm just going to say that... I might have been mildly inebriated with a group of friends, and we might have recorded a very long session of us talking out our characters. I don't know.
I love it.
And
that's kind of like Priyush and I have been writing a mystery thriller.
What?
For the majority of our relationship. Listen. I'll tell you about it later.
I have so many questions. Is the mustache the key suspect? So elusive.
It is now. Ooh, and there's a key suspect right here. Sorry, I'm going to have to say hi to my dog.
Oh, yeah, say hi to the dog. She's saying hi to the dog. This will probably get cut, but I'm singing a song, and it's mostly for Chad. No, it's not. Chad, you don't get to have anything. I know you hear this. You're going to keep it in.
He can probably... Let me just clean off the couch if he wants to.
Of course.
And we can just take off his collar so he doesn't make a sound.
Oh, silent little Domenico.
Okay, this is just for you, Jessica.
Oh.
But...
What is it? What's for me?
Preesh, you can sing this with Jessica.
What's...
So we make up songs for our pets.
Yes.
As one does.
Sure.
And the most recent one was that lately, late at night, our dog will ask to go to the bathroom. And he'll go outside and poop and then immediately roll in the grass like a crazy dog. Not like in his poop. He's like clean about it. But he just goes, wah! And so we have to like wipe him off at the end of the day. Or like when we come back in because he's just rolled in all this disgusting grass. So we have a song. Do you want to come and sing it, Preesh? It's a song we sing to him after he rolls in the grass. Okay, are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3. Wiping your body, wiping your body. You rolled everywhere, you rolled everywhere.
This is the greatest gift you've ever given me.
Thank the carpenter,
that's
better.
No problem.
Oh my god. Amazing.
Anyways, we're going to ancient history.
Oh yeah.
Mystery.
That's right.
And it's so cool. And so I chose this story right after, I think it was like right after all the female presidential candidates dropped out.
Right. Oh, the sad time. I've already blocked that out. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. The sad time before the time we were all sad because we were isolated.
Right.
That sad one.
Yes.
Oh my God. I saw this great meme about like 2020 and someone was like, you know, someone, maybe 2020 will be my year. And then it was like 2020 in March. And it's just that scene from The Office where Dwight has a fake fire and everybody's running around and like a cat falls out of the ceiling and everyone is screaming.
Oh my God, it's amazing.
Yeah, that's, I think that's my favorite scene in The Office. But anyways, that's where we are. So it's that sad time.
I love it.
And so I was just thinking a lot about female leadership and female representation and how it's so crazy that we don't see women as leaders because we have all these amazing examples of them. And here is one of them.
Oh my God.
And I'm so excited. And so first let's talk about research because I forgot last time. So thank you, Second Chance. Over Christmas break, the art store by my house had this book display of all these books about women in history.
What?
Yeah, I sent you like of those pictures of like all those covers. And then they have just like this feminist section in this like gift shop art store. And so they happen to have all these books that were basically like special Lady Day research materials. So I took a ton of pictures of the covers and sent them to you and was like, if you ever are in a dry spell with finding a lady, here are all these books and resources. And they had one about like queer women and one about, I don't know, it was just so cool. So I bought one, though, which I felt that was very on the nose for our podcast called Rad Women Worldwide.
Great.
And it's, like, illustrated, and it has this map of the world, and it has all these cool women from history, and it's by Katie Schatz. And it does these little profiles of them. And so, yeah, so I was like, I'm going to turn away from the internet, and I'm going to look at a book. And so this is my first woman from that. So thank you, Katie Schatz. And then my big source is the article from the Smithsonian by Elizabeth Wilson called The Queen Who Would Be King.
Oh.
And I know. And I quoted a ton of any time in this story that I quote like an outside scholarly source, like some kind of scholar saying this or some kind of expert. It's from Wilson's article. I am giving you the audio version of her article, essentially. But I did do some fact checking with Britannica just to make sure I was on the right track. That was very enlightening for some things we'll go into later. And then I have a bit of a quote about some recent news from LiveScience.com.
I love it.
Here we go.
Okay.
Okay. Get ready. History mystery. So, we're going to start. Picture this.
Picturing.
It's 1822. You are at Deir el-Bahri, an ancient Egyptian temple that you thought was once created by one of Egypt's great male pharaohs.
Sure.
You start to decode and read the hieroglyphs.
I do that all on the walls.
And you actually stumble upon...
What?
The story of the unknown, or until then unknown, Hatshepsut, one of ancient Egypt's few female kings. Dun, dun, dun! And you realize that the fortress you're standing in was created by a woman.
Okay. Do, 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 do. Listen, can I quickly... I need you to know exactly where my brain's going right now.
Where is your brain?
It is going straight to Lucille Bluth in Arrested Development when she gets surprised by that undercover detective that is really bad at his job. Oh, Jean Parmesan, I believe.
Yeah,
and she always Jean goes, Parmesan. Ah, he did it again. That's that's where I'm at. That's the level of enthusiasm I'm at.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, take me there. Take me there.
Okay. Yes. So ancient Egypt had a few, like, has had many queens, but only a few female pharaohs. When I actually told you before, I was like, she was the only one. But now I think there were a few others, and we're going to be cozy with questions. I don't know, and I kept trying to find it, but all of the sources I had to pay for subscriptions for, and I was like, no. So I don't know, but she is one of the few, if not the only female king in ancient Egypt. That said, the story of Hatshepsut had been hidden immediately after her reign so that even Cleopatra, who came later, may not have known about her existence. History mystery. So yeah, we're going to learn about her life and then the multiple erasures of her story that endured over three millennia. Dun, dun, dun. So let's get into it.
Get it.
Let's go to her origins.
Okay.
Her origins start off a little Game of Thrones Lannister-y, but we just have to remember that it was a different time.
Different time.
Yeah. Oh, and the little pooch is going to join us. Come on up here, baby.
Come on in, Domenico. It's time to learn about a woman whose history was almost erased.
Yeah. He's like, I'm down for it. He just played with his favorite lady, Meg the dog.
Meg the dog.
I know.
Very special.
I'll send you that video of them balancing goldfish on their noses together.
Can you? Can you also send it to all of our subscribers?
I can. Please. I can. It's so cute.
Thank you.
Okay. So Hatshepsut was born in 1508 BCE. Which is, as you know, I love timelines. This is a very long time ago.
Sure.
And I love thinking about how long ago it was.
Tell
so
me.
We take, like, the Renaissance, and then we add another Renaissance back in time.
What?
Backwards along the timeline.
What?
And that's how long ago it
was. There's so many Renaissances.
I know. It's just so long ago.
Wow.
I remember, I learned, like, when I've been traveling with Prish lately and going to museums, I learned how much I like timelines. We were in Bath and we were looking at those like famous Georgian houses that you see in Bath all the time. It's like, look at this row. It's like Crescent Row or something.
Yeah.
And then we went to the museum and Priyash was like, I'll wait outside. I'm sick of museums. And he was like, how was it? And I was like, they had a really great timeline. I was like, oh no, who am I? I love a good timeline.
Listen,
I like things organized. I want to see the order they happened.
It's great.
I need context.
It's perfect.
Anyways. So, long ass time ago. Okay. So, Hatshepsut means foremost of noble ladies. And she was the daughter of King Thutmose and Queen Ames. And so at that time, kings had like many queens of different levels of power.
Okay.
So that's why you'll kind of hear later, like, this person's husband had a son, but it wasn't for that. Like, that's just pretty normal.
Okay.
And so, Hatshepsut seems to have really idolized her father. She eventually reburied him in her tomb, in the tomb she was having built for herself. So yeah, she clearly idolized him. When her father died, this is the weird Lannister-y bit, she married her half-brother at the age of 12.
Okay.
And I'm going to assume ancient Egypt-wise, this is much more about, like, consolidating power than it is about, like, romance, lust, things
right.
like that.
Right.
I'm pretty sure it's about, like, family alliance. And this made her the great royal wife, which is the most powerful queen in Egypt.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but remember that queens do not have as much power as the king slash pharaoh.
Sure.
So even though she was the most powerful queen, she didn't have all the power. When her half-brother slash husband died, his power wasn't transferred to her, but her stepson. And so probably, you know, a son born from one of his other wives right. or queens. And he was Thutmose III. But he was a baby. And
right.
so she reigned for 7 years as the great royal wife. And she basically reigned on his behalf because babies cannot rule.
Yet.
So this was totally, yet, I know. Let's see. I always think about, like, isn't there a town that does actually have, like, a dog as a mayor somewhere?
Maybe.
I don't know. Preach was telling me about it. And like, they're like, we're a tiny town of, like, 12 people.
And
have
this
dog be our mayor. Anyways.
I mean. It's tiny yeah, paw prints but, all over the legislature.
Oh, just imagine the little suits you'd wear every day. Okay, so, yeah, she ran on his behalf, and, you know, like, according to the way she was portrayed in statues and images, she did this with grace and also deference. Like, he was always shown first, and even though he was a baby in Egypt, and this is really important as we kind of get further in, and you'll know why, in Egypt, statues always, they did not portray reality, but
okay.
kind of the way they thought things should be or could be.
Okay.
So, like, because the baby was the ruler, he was portrayed as an adult, and she was behind him,
I
but
see.
Really he was an infant.
Right.
So, like, they're kind of these, like, I don't want to say magical thinking, but these kind of imaginings of, like, a visual display of the power relationship, not necessarily the people.
Yeah.
And that's going to be really important. So, anyways, and the way that was portrayed that way, you know, she really understood her role. And this is kind of important for later. She did, though, 7 years later, take her control a step further. She, and we don't know why, but I want to be really clear that recent research does not think that she took on this new role. It wasn't necessarily like a power grab. And so from the Smithsonian article by Elizabeth Wilson, more recent scholarship. I'm going to stop until you stop, Sophie. What we think happens is that this move that Hatshepsut made wasn't a power grab. It was probably in response to some kind of political crisis. And we don't know
okay.
what, but we can think that it was probably like a threat from some kind of competing branch of the royal family
okay.
that kind of required her to take on more power and become the pharaoh. So that's exactly what she does. She basically declares herself king, which I think I'm like, that's a pretty badass power move. Like, you don't need any reason behind that. Like, that's
right.
pretty cool on its own. It's like a pretty badass move. But she basically says,
yeah.
queen is not enough. I am going to name myself king.
I mean, come on.
Right? It's like that move alone. I'm like, oh. Gotta get tears out. Okay. And so we think that she probably did this to protect her stepson and
okay.
to kind of protect his lineage. And kind of as I said before, Egyptian queens could be powerful, but it was not the same as the king who had this kind of overarching power.
Okay.
So she declared herself the sixth pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. She's just like, hello, I am king. And like, that's kind of, it's always has this like masculine connotation, so already there's this like contradiction here. She's like, I am this female king. It's amazing.
So good.
And she also kind of said, because she knew that people weren't going to be into it, so she was like, my father had always wanted me to rule. I'm taking my rightful place. Yeah, I know. It was really cool. So, and this wasn't at all a cruel takeover, which is important to know too.
Okay.
She treated her stepson with complete respect. And even like kind of later in her years ruling as she got older, he took more control, you know?
Oh.
So it was kind of like, she's like guiding him.
Yeah.
And kind of, yeah. So anyways.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it wasn't like he was under house arrest at all. He, once he came of age, he went off to like learn how to be a good soldier and things like that. And people might say like, oh, but couldn't she have like stepped down once he became of age? But that's not really the way, just like the way Egyptians conceived of kingship, which is important to know.
Okay.
And so I have this from Renee Dreyfus, who I got from the Smithsonian article. And so it's basically like, once you took on the attributes of kingship, That was it, this woman says, Renee Dreyfus. She says, you are a god. It's not queen for a day. It's king for all time.
Wow.
Yeah. So she can't just, like, reverse that suddenly.
Fuck.
Because you, like, transcend. So you can't just, like, rescind that.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So she's like, hello, I'm here. I am the divine king. Here I am.
NBD, guys.
Yeah.
Here I am.
No big deal. I am just going to rule this place. And so she knew, though, that she had to really convince the Egyptian people. She was aware that her situation was a little tenuous. So she does what any smart person does who wants to change their title, change their public reputation. She goes on a marketing campaign and rebrands the hell out of herself. Yeah.
Stop. A rebrand.
She goes on a rebrand. She's like, you thought I was just queen. Guess what? I'm king. Here are all the things. So this is very, very circumspect and very wise, all the things that she did. And so I'll kind of take you through all the changes she made to her image for the Egyptian people.
Okay.
So she ordered carvings to be made of her on temple walls that depicted her as both the daughter of her father, King Thutmose, but also of the god Amun. And so at that time, Amun was kind of the most revered king of the gods during that dynasty in particular.
Wow.
His name meant hidden one. And so it meant that he was kind of invisible. And it's kind of cool, like in images on walls, he was painted blue to denote that he's invisible, which is kind of cool. And this concept of invisibility led to a belief in the New Kingdom, which is kind of the age that they're in, that he had this sense of knowledge and impartiality, which is really interesting.
That's really cool.
And he was kind of the god for those that are oppressed. Oh. So making her the daughter of the impartial and most powerful god is a pretty good endorsement.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's a great sign off.
Yeah, so she's like, look, he's cool with me. We're ready to go.
Yeah.
He's my father. Also, my father is my father. Deal with it.
Right.
She also then does a little bit more with her images. And this is the really interesting part. And remember that these images are kind of these projections of power dynamics.
Okay.
And the way that they interpret them.
Okay.
So she depicts herself as herself on, like, temple walls and in statues, but also with these additions of these male king features.
Oh.
So sometimes she'll have a long beard. Sometimes she'll have that, like, striped headdress that you think of with, like, ancient Egyptian imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes she has a woman's body with a beard. Other times she has this really masculine body. And so I kind of told you the last time we had talked about this that, like, I had these different reactions, and then I had to go and read the, like, Egyptian interpretation. But my first reaction was like, whoa, what an interesting, like, queer moment of images. This is so cool.
Right.
And it's very much through, like, my 2020 feminist lens that I'm like, we're blending gender and all these things. And so I was like, wow, that's really cool. But then I had a second and I was like, hey, women's bodies are also really strong. Why do we need all these muscles and beards? You know?
Right.
I was like, why do we need to portray, like, why does strength have to come with these masculine bodies? Aren't we strong enough?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I quickly interject?
Yeah. Interject.
I think this part is so interesting because, to take it a step further, right, of course, as you're talking about, like, this, you know, 2020 perspective, not that this hasn't, this perspective and this actuality and this truth and this reality hasn't existed far before 2020, but we talk about it maybe more openly now. Of course, there isn't, like, as we were saying earlier, like, fuck the binary. There isn't, like, one way to be masculine. There isn't one way to be feminine. But I think what I hear you saying that's really interesting is you're, like, looking at it with this lens and you're like, oh, this is maybe what was kind of happening, right? Like, this kind of almost blurring of the binary and this, like, understanding that these traits are not inherent. And then you're like, wait, no, not what they were doing. They were doing something else. And it was really specific to that time. And it meant something that she would be like, hey, look at these traditionally masculine traits that I am merging into my image. It's just really interesting to dissect, because on the one hand you're like, well, like you're saying, like, why does that happen? Why did she have to do that to portray strength? That's, like, annoying. You know, like,
yeah,
because these traditionally feminine physicalities are just as strong. And it must be fascinating in your own mind as you're researching to kind of take both of those, both of those knowledges and be like, oh, wait, but what were they actually, like, what was actually happening culturally
at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so here it is. And so this is the best of our abilities. And I think it's so fascinating, too. We have to, like, put on these little ancient Egypt hats and kind of be like, well, what did they see? Because we can have our own, like, wonderful. And I think in a way, like, it's okay if we interpret her as, like, this fascinating queer character.
Yes.
But, like, we also just have to understand that, like, we're not wearing the ancient Egyptian lenses on things. And that we have to, like, really change the way we see the world to even get there.
Right.
So there was this really clear. So this is kind of. Kathleen Keller, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at UC Berkeley, told Elizabeth Wilson from the Smithsonian kind of how to read this. So there wasn't really any pretending to be a man at all. The people who saw it would know she was a woman, but she's taking on these quote-unquote kingly images that kind of, this is the power that she has. And so, and she always adds, it's very interesting, she always puts in a touch of her true gender. So an example of that is she had her title as the daughter of Re, which is kind of like, usually it's like the son of Re, or she'll have these feminine word endings. So she'll have these really weird titles. And one of them is His Majesty Herself, which I love. I'm just like, oh, this is so weird.
Band name.
Yeah, I know, right? Or something. Maybe get it tattooed. Who knows? But, like, very interesting playing with the different meanings of gender and what is your true self and then what is this, like, projected power symbol, I guess.
So fascinating.
So interesting. And she even changes, so she goes even further and she even changes her name. She changes her name to Mat-Ka-Re, which, of course, has some very important symbolism. Which I will translate for you.
Thank you.
Not because I know anything about it, but because I learned about it a couple of days ago. So Mat means truth. And so it basically means truth is the soul of the sun god. Ugh. So truth is Mat, soul is Ka, and sun god is Re. And so truth is, that word Mat is really important because it's an ancient Egyptian expression for order and justice that's established by God. Or by the gods. So it kind of, it legitimizes her power because it's kind of like this divine truth.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So cool.
So she's very, very smart. And she like, this concept of Mat kind of maintains and perpetuates prosperity and stability. That kind of thing that's required for, like, a legitimate pharaoh to stay in power. So she's totally legitimizing herself. And, you know, we were talking about how, like, in our day and age, there's so much uncertainty about, like, can a woman rule? Da, 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 da.
Right.
Well, guess what? Hatshepsut's rule, she nails it.
Of course she does.
It's a successful and peaceful 22-year reign. And unlike the previous pharaohs who kind of reigned by causing war and skirmishes, she developed positive relationships with neighboring countries, and it was a time of peace.
Ugh.
She did a really good job.
Yeah, she nailed it.
In every step of the way. And also she did this amazing thing. So instead of, like, investing her money in war, she invested her money in infrastructure and art, essentially. Right? And it's like, I wonder if we could learn from this right now. So she basically kind of commissions all these new construction projects. And I kind of imagine it as, like, the Egyptian version of the New Deal.
I love this.
So she restores all these monuments and temples that had been ruined in war that were getting older. And then she builds this gigantic burial temple that is considered one of the greatest works of Egyptian architecture. And that's what I mentioned earlier, where she had kind of been discovered in the late 1800s.
Right.
Deir el-Bahri. I hope I'm spelling it right. And this place, I'm going to put pictures up on social media when we put out our post.
But
this place is amazing and I want to go there. Like, can we have a special Lady Day trip to Egypt, please?
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So, and I remember, I think I told you this, when I was looking for pictures at first, I looked at it and I was like, oh, is this like a modern museum?
Yeah.
That is, like, so, and then you go inside and then you have access because it looks so modern. It looks very, Like, you think of ancient Egypt as all these intricate carvings.
Right.
And this one is very, it's minimal. And it kind of reminds me almost of, like, this weird mid-century modern 1960s, like,
yeah.
stark columns that you see.
Love it.
Yeah, and so I'm just going to describe it to you. And this is kind of paraphrased from that Smithsonian article. It's so beautiful. And so what it is it's like these dramatic red cliffs, like these desert cliffs, and then this smooth, gorgeous, elegant temple shoots right out at the bottom.
Wow.
And it just looks so, it looks so unreal. And so it's these limestone cliffs, and it's kind of dramatically seated there at the bottom. Regarded as one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world.
Wow.
And it's basically these series of terraced colonnades and courtyards that kind of just appear up the side of the mountain. It's a huge scale, like roughly the length of 2.5 football fields. So this is like really big.
Wow.
But even though it's huge, it's not menacing. It's very light and graceful. And so it's very unlike the temples that had been built before. This is kind of like a huge architectural feat.
Wow.
And apparently the temple's lower levels featured pools and gardens planted with fragrant trees. This is Our Lady Oasis.
Oh, basically. My God. Midnight at the Lady Oasis.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah, yeah. All of our favorite ladies are just peering through little leaves. They're lounging in the pools. It's going to be great. But also she did add supersized images of herself everywhere.
Sure.
And they're massive and masculine. Sure. And they're meant to be seen from a distance.
Oh, boy.
So it's this interesting place of like power and mm-hmm. grace.
Ugh.
Like all in one. It's gorgeous. So anyways, all around she did great.
Yeah.
She did really well.
Nailed it. Nailed it.
This is where the story gets complicated. You thought we were over. This could be a great place. Mm, and then we end.
Oh, but guess
no,
what?
This is where the story gets interesting and frustrating.
Sure.
Towards the end of her life, she really wanted her legacy to endure and to be recognized, taking credit for what she did.
Duh.
So she had hundreds of statues placed all over in her temples, shrines to herself, and detailed accounts of her life. And Katie Schatz from the Rad Women Worldwide says it best. She says, perhaps she worried that future generations wouldn't believe a woman could rule as she had, or that someone might try to erase her legacy.
Right.
And unfortunately, as you know, but our listeners don't yet, Hatshepsut's predictions came true twice. So after she died, her stepson became king, Thutmose III. And then later in his reign... and we don't know the details at all. And so this is kind of where the speculation is going to come up later. But her name was scratched out of all the temple walls.
Come on.
Her face was smashed on all the statues. And her story, all that legacy she was trying to, like, build in to the infrastructure around her, was forgotten for nearly 3,500 years.
Like, what does a woman have to do?
I know. She's like, I made everything beautiful and peaceful for you. And they're like, nope. Smash.
I just...
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I know. And then in the most... Oh, I'm going to take a sip of water before I get really mad.
Yeah, you need to hydrate for this.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So, unfortunately, I mean, it's great that she was found.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, at the time, she was found by some white male archaeologists, and it gets a lot worse.
What? No, it's Caitlin, like, you're telling me some white male archaeologist made a discovery and then they altered history in a really negative way? I am shocked.
They kind of fucked it up.
Shocked.
Yeah. This is where it gets very frustrating, but I'm also thankful we live, like, in the decade we live in, because even the Britannica article I was looking at, I was like, there are some things added here that did not need to be here, and it's all historical speculation. It's stupid.
Mm-hmm. You tell Britannica. You tell them.
Usually they're my heroes, but this time around. So anyways, as you can tell, there are going to be some big misinterpretations of what these people find. So, so as I said, she was, like, it was kind of starting to get discovered in the late 1800s, and then in the early 20th century is really, like, when we get archaeologists thinking about her kind of seriously, and it's trying to kind of piece together her story. But unfortunately, those archaeologists, who were all male, portrayed her as a power-hungry villain.
I mean,
and the Metropolitan Museum of Art's William C. Hayes called her the vilest type of usurper. So essentially, Wilson from the Smithsonian explains, the historians had crafted the few known facts of her life into a soap opera of deceit, lust, and revenge.
Weird. So unlike Men in Power.
I know. It's like, really misinterpreting everything and getting it all wrong?
Changing the narrative for your own devices?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, and I'm going to go through in all the details and the ways that they really messed up. But essentially what they saw was this not only, like, a female inhabiting a traditionally male role, but also they saw these masculine portrayals of a woman and they freaked the fuck out. And they didn't know what to do. And so in their little brains, like, the only thing they could do was translate it into, like, she must be a villain. Like, there must be something deviant and wrong with her. And, like, also, she probably couldn't have, like, gotten this power anyways without the help of, like, some evil man. So, we will go into all the details. So, as I said before, they were, like, perturbed by her masculine portrayals of herself. And they called it an act of outrageous deception or deviant behavior. And I think that word deviant is so, like, dog whistling, especially for, like, any kind of gender bending.
Yeah.
Or, like, not non-traditionally feminine types.
Right, right.
They also thought that there must be a man behind her power grab. And so what we're talking about, and this is why I was really careful with that, like, move to call herself king, is that it was, as we know now, not some kind of, like, wah-ha-ha-ha-ha, I'm going to take power. It was, like, this very strategic move, like all politicians make.
Sure. Of course.
Right?
Right.
But no. They thought, how could a woman do this? There must be a man behind it. And so Hatshepsut had a chief minister named Senemut. And they thought that he could have been, like, her lover and her co-conspirator and kind of the evil genius behind her, like, devious politics. And so this is completely made up. And this is where I was disappointed with the Britannica, because they mention Senemut and they say he could have, he's rumored to have been her lover, yet we have no evidence proving that. And I was like, well, then why do you even put it in the article?
Right. What's, like, the point?
It's not true at all. But what we do know about Senemut, which is pretty cool, is that he was the one who really helped oversee the building of her temple.
Great.
And so, like, awesome. He was doing what any person who works for someone does. She, like, delegated and he's like, cool, got it. That's what we know.
Oh my god.
But this gem of a historian, Alan Gardner, wrote that not even a woman of the most virile character could have attained such a pinnacle of success without masculine support.
I would like to set myself on fire.
I'd like to set Alan Gardner on fire.
That might be more accurate.
And actually, we had talked about setting, I remember when you first heard this, you were like, I want to set that quote on fire.
Fire should happen at some point.
Yeah. Well, and it's so interesting that, like, that is your reaction twice, is like, something is very wrong and awful about this interpretation.
It just
shows his own, like, his own lack of imagination or understanding of the way the world works.
Right. So, well, and we talked to more at the end, and I don't need to get into it all again, but just the danger of the lack of imagination when it comes to imagining what women are capable of.
Absolutely.
Right? Like, in several versions of that word, right? You can go any which way in terms of imagining that a woman could be president, imagining, you know, and there's a lot of things, and sometimes it can go other, like, negative way, right? Like, imagining that a white woman would be weaponizing her tears, which I'm like, no, imagine it. It happens. Like, for sure.
But yeah.
But that, just that lack of imagination, how dangerous it is.
So, and then they, with this, like, destruction of these tombs, destruction of all these statues, they interpreted, these archaeologists interpreted the destruction as an act of long-awaited bitter revenge on the part of Thutmose III. They portrayed him as, like, scarcely waiting to take vengeance on her, you know, that he had dared not to do in life. So, like, he's just waiting because he's been so wronged, and so he's this, like, hero for, like, avenging himself. And so this, I mean, Gardner said this in 1961. So that's like, it's really not a long time ago that people were thinking these insane things.
Nope.
And so luckily we have some scholars now who have more voices of reason, but still clearly, like with that Britannica article, the echoes of this are still there.
Yeah.
But Renee Dreyfus portrays it wonderfully. She is a curator of ancient art and interpretation at the Fine Arts Museum in San Francisco. And she says she has the most polite burn, which I love. So I'm just going to read it and we'll think about what she feels on the inside versus what she says on the outside. Right. She says, "Of course it made a wonderful story. And that is what we all read when we were growing up. But so much of what is written about Hatshepsut had to do with who the archaeologists were. Gentlemen scholars of a certain generation."
Oh, my God.
I know. And I love that because it's like she's saying all the, she's thinking all the things we're saying, but she's also, she's like, I am a professional. I'm going to say they were of a certain generation that we're glad no longer exists.
I will not squeal and shriek like Jessica Lohafer, who keeps threatening to set herself or other things on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but I do want to offer some thoughts though about like Tutmose's move, and I don't want to remove all of the like it wasn't just because of patriarchy, like it very much could be, and so people are kind of going back and forth. We still don't really know why Tutmose did what he did, and again, we're kind of attributing it to him. We don't know if it was him, but it happened at the end of his reign, and definitely happened under his watch.
Okay.
So some people think. So basically what proves all of these dum-dums wrong is that he did this at the end of his reign. So had it been this vengeful thing right after he took the throne, he would have done that, right? But it's interesting that the timing, it happened kind of at the end. So people are kind of considering, like, it's probably not like a rampage, and it's probably not this emotional act of vengeance. What is it? Yeah. And so we're trying to figure that out. Okay. Some people think that he thought it was, for some reason, we don't know why, necessary to rewrite history. And we don't know what that means. And so it could be that for some kind of securing of his own lineage, much like Hatshepsut did for him, he had to make this move for some reason. Huh. Or it could be that he was afraid of, like, female intervention in his male line. He still could be reacting to this female power. So, like, we don't know, but it probably wasn't because he didn't like her personally, you know, or that she had done anything wrong.
Yeah.
But that doesn't give him, like, a free pass.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we are. Like, we just don't, we really don't
know.
Oh, and I have a really good quote from the Smithsonian article kind of explaining this theory about him trying to erase her. And they thought that her reign was just too conventional and that it set this kind of quote-unquote dangerous precedent that was best erased.
Jesus.
To kind of prevent the possibility of another powerful female ever inserting herself into the long line of Egyptian kings. So, yeah. So, again, this is all conjecture. And I think this woman, Joyce Tidesley, a scholar and biographer of Hatshepsut, she said she's like an iceberg. On the surface, we know quite a lot about her, but there is so much more we don't know, which I kind of love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, and I just think we have to be really careful not to, like, jump to conclusions.
Sure.
Speaking of that, though, we think that we have found her. And so the Smithsonian article that I've been getting a lot of information from was written in 2009. And at the point that it was written, in 2007, an Egyptian archaeologist had identified a previously excavated mummy from the Valley of Kings as her.
Oh.
But that 2009 article, it says the evidence is not conclusive, further studies are in progress. However, by 2016, articles were kind of saying she has been found. Okay. But again, I do just want to put like an asterisk around that because I don't know for sure and I don't... I had a lot of trouble finding what the prevailing thoughts were about it.
Okay.
But in an article from Live Science, it kind of explains the exciting way they found her. And so basically, they did a scan of a single tooth in a box with Hatshepsut's name on it. and it perfectly matched a tooth socket in that mummy's jaw.
Oh!
Yeah, and that was from Cornell University anthropologist Meredith Small.
Oh my god, Caitlin.
So that's kind of fun.
Caitlin.
Yeah.
I have two words for you.
Yeah.
History mystery.
History mystery. Is it her? Maybe it is. So I don't. So like, it could be her. And also, this is kind of, it's a little unflattering, but also like, she did a lot of stuff. Meredith Small from Cornell says that the mummy reveals that she was around 50 when she died, balding, suffering from diabetes, but wearing a black and red nail polish, and she also clearly had a desire for perfume.
Well, you know what? If when I'm gonna go someday. Clearly had a desire for perfume. Not bad.
That's fine. Yeah, and put black and red nail polish together.
Oh, yeah. That's
sexy. And also, like, she was running an entire country. Of course she's going to be balding. We'll see. And she's wealthy. She's eating all that sugar. Of course she's going to have diabetes. Right. Anyways. Well,
and who knows? Maybe she was type 1. Maybe it was just genetic. And no shame in the snack game. You do what you want.
Yeah. So, anyways, and I kind of think that's, like, a wonderful portrait of her. I'm like, she sounds really fantastic. Cool. So I want to end with this idea, though, and this thought that, as I had said before, Hatshepsut was very aware of and worried about constantly about how people would remember her. Remember how she would write her life story over and over and over again, like on these temple walls. And she had images of herself over and over and over.
Right.
And so the same scholar that I mentioned earlier, Tildesley, she says, I'm going to quote her. She says, "This is just speculation, but I think she was almost aware that she might be forgotten or that her actions would be misunderstood." Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably pretty true. She's kind of worried about this. And so it's kind of an example. One of the inscriptions that Hatshepsut wrote toward the end of her reign, and these are on these obelisks, say, "My heart turns this way and that, as I think what the people will say, those who shall see my monuments in years to come, and speak of what I have done."
Oh my god.
But Hatshepsut, we're speaking about you.
Guess what?
We love you. We love your style choices.
We love your style choices. We're talking about it. We're trying to remember you. Now, was she thinking many a millennia ago that two post-grad 30-somethings would be sipping white wine, maybe wearing pants, maybe not. Let's leave that undetermined.
Wearing these things called leggings, at least in my
That's
side.
What's happening. And, like,
chatting about her.
You know, maybe it isn't exactly how she imagined it, but guess what? It's happening.
We're talking about her. And also, guess what? You don't have to pay for a subscription to the Washington Post or National Geographic to get this information, because
That's
we are
right.
a free podcast.
We are $0.
Yeah, but yeah, like, I love, I kind of, and that's, I guess, you know, I'd said earlier that I had been thinking about her a lot, and I will just sometimes pause and think about this woman. I'm like, she was thinking about the people who would think about her, and here I am, like, 3,000, almost 4,000 years later, thinking about her, it's just amazing. Like, walking to the grocery store, and, like, being inspired by her, and, like, feeling frustrated on her behalf for all of that injustice her story suffered, and just loving her.
It's beautiful.
So we love you, Hatshepsut.
It's wonderful. Caitlin, great job.
Thank you. Great job to you.
Oh, now we're all thinking about her, and some of us are tearing up. The story must be told. Wow.
I know. And that's why it was so frustrating, I think, when we lost that episode.
I know.
Because we were just like, we can't just, like, let this slide and not do it again.
No.
You know,
we have to get it.
Yeah. And she's so fascinating. And yeah. And I am just really hoping that, here's my wish. My Hatshepsut-esque wish is that somebody listens to this in the future when there are a whole lot more female leaders in the world. And they're like, wow, their wishes came true.
Yeah. Oh, that makes me so sad and also
I'm
happy.
Sorry.
No, it's
And there
okay.
are a lot of female leaders.
Yes.
However, in many symbolic positions, there are still not.
Yes. Many more outside of America.
Yeah.
Outside, well, there's many in America, but not at the highest point of power.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Hey, Nancy Pelosi. Wow. These special ladies.
So good.
We did it.
We really did it.
Thanks for being there for me during these times. For being there for each other.
You too. I have an idea along those lines. I'd like to pitch at you.
Pitch me an idea.
Which, like, for the first time, this isn't, like, a fabricated surprise.
We actually have a few fabricated surprises. Okay.
I'm wondering, I know you are still working and very busy, and I want to respect that, but I'm wondering if outside of our regular recording schedule during this particular moment of isolation, we might do some tiny little baby 7-minute, 10-minute, whatever, special lady mental health check-ins.
I love it.
That we might release occasionally, maybe with like a piece of good news or just some honest reflection of where we're at, but just like short little things.
Saying hi.
Yeah, yes. Just like saying hi, talking about the animals, whatever. Maybe we'll figure out Instagram Live. I mean, let's not put too high of a thing, but
that would be so fun. Happen.
But it could be really fun. It's gonna be you, Mead, and Chad.
Yeah.
No. But that's okay.
It's gonna be great.
Listen, we're building it. We're building it, and they will come.
But, they will come.
And the people we have, we absolutely love. But separate from that, maybe not.
We just know you're really busy.
Yeah, you're really busy and we get it. So maybe not Instagram Live, but little we'll mini guys. Like a mini mini.
Little mini like minis. I was going to try to think of a way to put mini in pandemic, but I don't think it's possible.
Minemic?
A panda mini?
A panda mini mini? No. Okay, we're going to workshop this. It's okay. We've got two creative writing master's degrees.
I know, we can figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure it out. But I also, I don't want us to end without doing a quick special lady shout out.
Yes, which is something that I invented last time and then we lost the recording. Yes. So yes. That's why it's new to you guys, but not new to us.
Right. Do you like how I'm like, I would like to do it and it, you came up with it? I'm like,
no, it's okay. I just want to, I wanted to explain the context. They're not like, what the fuck? Yeah. Do you want to explain a special lady shout out?
You do it.
Okay, so I was just thinking, like, along the lines when we, and we're still working on those special lady love letters, too, because we had our sound issue, and now we can record it. So that kind of made me think about, like, maybe we could have a chance to, like, highlight some special ladies that we're noticing.
Yes.
And I don't know, do you want to, are you going to do the same one?
No, I have a new one, and I want to go last.
Okay, can I give the example of yours?
Yes.
From last time? Sure. So, yeah, I like, put you on the spot. I was like, who's a special lady that you encountered?
Right.
Just this week. And it could be on social media or in real life. But just, and kind of along the lines that you're saying too, of like, special ladies don't have to look like these big sweeping, they don't all have to be female pharaohs.
Right.
Even though we love them.
Right.
But like, special ladies, they're amazing in so many different ways. And right. So the one that you brought up last time, which I loved, your nephew was just born.
Yes. Right?
And he had been like, the day or two before
we recorded,
and you had said that there was this nurse who, I think, also shout out to all of our special people in healthcare.
My God, you guys are actual damn heroes right now.
I love you all so much, and every time I think about how grateful I am, I just start crying. So anyways, but this woman, she worked in the maternity ward, and you had observed her kind of as you were waiting. For your own family's baby to be born. You were observing her every time a family, like, brought out a new baby, right?
Yep.
She would, like, stand up, go up to the baby, and you tell me what she said.
Okay, she would always say, oh, welcome to the world, little one.
Wasn't it that sweet? And the thing that really got me was that you said that she did it with such a genuine excitement.
Yeah.
And it was special to this family. And it was, even though she probably said it 20 times a day.
Right.
It was like this heartfelt, wonderful thing that I love to think about is buried deep, deep, deep in the subconscious of every single person that was born there.
Yes!
But
love
like,
it.
That's a special lady, right? And so I think it would be a great way for us to close it out. It feels good. We can just try it out. And if we decide we want to switch to something else, we can.
Yeah, we'll do what we want.
And, okay, I'll go with the special lady that I wanted to shout out. And I can't read her stuff on my phone because, oh, I can get her Instagram account here. So this is an Instagram person I've been following. So the person that I'm going to recommend, I got this from my friend Becca, who is a friend of the podcast.
Yes.
And she has introduced me to, My Favorite Murder. She's introduced me to my favorite podcast, like Dad Wrote a Porno, like all these things. And so when Becca was like, hey, you should check out this wonderful Instagram account, I was like, absolutely. So it's curated by this woman named Dr. Kiona, and she was born in Hawaii. And I think she's of like Austrian and Asian heritage. Anyways, she is a woman who's like clearly professional, smart, talented, and interesting, and has also observed a lot of complicated ways to travel growing up in Hawaii.
Yes.
And so she does this amazing work where she basically gives you, it's called How to Not Travel Like a Basic Bitch.
Love it.
And it's like, here are the things you should not do or should do when you are traveling places. And I love how, and it's a very person of color centered space.
Love it.
This is not for the white gaze, and she makes that very clear over and over and over again. So I feel really grateful that I have access to just listen and learn from her.
Yep.
And actually something that was really sweet, I DM'd her on one of her stories because she was getting a lot of like really crappy, like she was posting about, it's called xenophobia, but basically like Asian phobia with coronavirus. Mm-hmm. And she was getting the screamiest of screamy white women yelling at her. And I had just texted her this thing that was like, I was just like, somebody just said something that really shocked me. And I just impulse responded. I was like, I am so sorry you have to deal with that. And she gave me a little heart.
Oh.
Yeah. It was so nice. Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, she's just great. And the thing that I love about her, and I'm going to read a bit. So for every 10,000 followers, she posts a booty shot of her on some kind of beach, just like she calls them ass shots. And I am going to read you what she says in one of them. She's been getting 10,000 followers a lot lately. So sometimes there are like two booty shots per day. She says, hi, my name is Kiona and I post ass shots every 1,000 followers to let you know that what you do with your body has no correlation with your intelligence, character, amount of money you make, business savvy, professionalism, or really anything. It just means you're a bitch on a beach and that's it.
Awesome.
So anyways, she's this like wonderful harmony of humor and intelligence, and is also a very key inside look about just the ways that you act in the world reflecting back.
Yeah. Awesome.
And teaching about it. And she just did this amazing three-part series, and she does these story series like for different parts of the world. She just did a three-parter about Sudan, which was amazing. Wow. And what it's like traveling in Sudan. And actually, she just posted, and this is perfect timing, she just posted a story about black pharaohs and about the pyramids in Sudan, which I guess is like kind of all this unknown history. We usually focus on ancient Egypt and all of their pharaohs, but there are all these black pharaohs and pyramids in Sudan, and I'm excited to learn about it. So anyways, How to Not Travel Like a Basic Bitch. She's funny. She does these curated trips. She's been doing curated trips to Cuba with a person of color focus, and so she'll reserve a certain number of spots on her trip for people of color, and then the tour guide she has, she also reserves. So, she's great, and she also has a couple of things just about, like, how to engage with an Instagram influencer and how not to be a dick that way.
That's awesome.
So anyway, sorry, I'm going on about her, but follow her. She's great. She's so funny and so smart, and I feel so grateful that this information is there. Thank you, Dr. Kiona.
Thank you so much. It.
Okay. That's my special lady shout out. You go.
Okay. This is mine. I'm going to keep it brief because I don't want to get too verklempt on the podcast. Okay. I don't mind being emotional, but I would like not to make a mess of myself if possible. Yeah. But my special lady shout out this week or this episode is to someone you also know. And her name is Dr. Laura Lofredo. And I first met Dr. Lofredo in my undergrad, what feels to be a million years ago. And back then, real quick backstory, it was my last quarter of my last year at Western for my bachelor's degree. It was the last week of the quarter. I was almost graduated, and I got dumped by my partner of like 3.5 years and had a total meltdown, and I had papers due, and I reached out to Professor Lofredo and was just like, oh God, this happened. What can I do? Can I have an extension, et cetera, et cetera? And she was wonderful. And at one point she was like, if you need anything else, let me know. And I remember I emailed her and I said, can you send me a thesis about, like, a thesis statement about how I'm going to be okay? Because everyone's telling me that I'm going to be okay, and I don't, like, really believe it. So if you could send me, like, a researched statement, that'd be really useful. And she did. She sent me this long email about, like, when a young woman finds herself at the end of a relationship, she might consider I mean, it was, like, so beautiful, and it made me cry, and I still have it, and I read it whenever. Whenever anybody I know goes through a breakup, I send it to them. I'm like, here you go. Just read this. It'll help you. But so it just, like, started this tradition of, like, when my life falls apart, I email Professor Laura Lofredo, and I go,
oh my gosh,
my life has fallen apart, what do I do? And so I emailed her this week, of course, and was like, Lofredo, I'm unemployed, I'm 33, what the hell, I thought I was done with all this upheaval, what do I do, oh my God, what do I do? And she wrote me the nicest email back in the midst of, I'm sure, a very busy and stressful time for her, because I bet all of her classes are also online suddenly. And, mm-hmm. you know, she has so much going on. But she wrote me, like, this gorgeous letter back, including a section where she advised me to go back and read the Custom House introduction to Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, where he talks about being fired and how he felt about it. Spoiler alert, very dramatic. Very dramatic.
I'm not surprised.
Not surprised. And H, really over the top. And she closed it out by being like, and 33? 33 is the age when there's no more interrupting major pivotal life moments? And she's like, oh my goodness, no, no, no. Jesus Christ himself wasn't even crucified until he was 33. Which I really appreciated. She's like, obviously, many monumental things happen after this point. But it was just so sweet and so kind, and I feel so grateful that I have someone in my life that at any point, seemingly, in my adult trajectory, I can just email and be like, everything is ruined again. Oh no, what do I do? And every time she's like, it's going to be better. It's going to be greater than you can imagine. This is the right, like, this is a good thing that's happened, even if it doesn't feel good, even if it feels terrible. And I've now accumulated a collection of these, like, letters from her telling me I'm going to be okay.
Oh my God.
And it's so sweet.
I love that.
So,
I love it so much.
Laura Lofredo, you are my special lady shout out.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, and, like, I guess I just want to offer that up. I'm not saying that I have the same lives as other people, because obviously I don't. But if you find yourself in a kind of similarly, well, what the hell am I going to do? I just got dumped. I just got fired. I got, you know, I'm not going to speak to how systems of power ruin people's lives, because obviously they often do. But just heart to heart, I believe in you. I think you're going to get through it. I think we're going to get through it together. And we're going to come out of this. We're going to build a world that is different out of necessity. And maybe we will make it even better than it is right now.
Let's do it. I'm inspired.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, anyway. LL from the bottom of my heart. Ugh, I just love her.
Ugh, oh man. So,
that's it. Let's go drink LaCroix and cry about it.
Wow. Yeah, but we are going to get through it. You guys are doing great, whatever you're doing.
Yeah,
whether it's having subtitles as a teaching moment.
Yep, that's fine.
Whether you're just staring out the window.
That's okay, too. Yeah. And we'll think of some things. If we start doing these, like, special lady mental health check-ins, we'll come up with some physical, tangible resources. We'll post some things.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll come at you with something, even if it's, like, sandwiched in us talking. Thank you for sticking there. But we'll try to bring something to the table every time, too. Even if it takes us a while to get there.
And if you, and if any of our listeners have ideas for good ways to get through this time, you could always...
Oh, my God. What have you guys been doing?
Yes. How are you doing it? How are you surviving? DM us. Slide into our DMs. I heard that's a thing kids say. So slide on through.
Oh, my gosh.
Send us an email at speciallady.day.podcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. You know?
And just...
Comment on our whatevers.
But yeah, just let us know what you're doing, and we really love you, and just be so gentle with yourselves.
Yeah, with yourselves and with each other.
Yes, 100%. Okay.
Okay.
Caitlin.
Until next time. Yeah?
I love you.
I love you, too. Hang in there.
Okay. Hey, you too.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.